Accession number 18191, Reel 7.
John Allen, Reel 4. More on the B2 then.
Well, do you want me to finish a little bit about...
On the jet stream.
I just finished the Stalling story. To try and solve these stalling problems and get the thing to do a nose drop, the aerodynamics department devised various different wing leading edges, and we would change wing leading edges in the hope that we could solve the problem. But all that happened was that the wing dropping became more vicious until it was turning right upside down when you got to the point where it should normally stall. It would just flick straight over, and you didn't know which way it was going to go. It would go either way. And so they tried eventually one more system. And one day when Neil Williams was flying it, and he was one of our test pilots, he was the aerobatics man, whom a lot of people remember, he was flying it with this latest mod, and the thing did a complete flick roll and came back the right way up. And he came back and reported to the aerodynamics department, "You've solved it. It just turns around and sits up and looks at us the right way up." Well, of course, this wasn't going to flatter the ARB very much, I can say. But Neil Williams loved it. Suited him down to the ground. Anyhow, the end result was that we had to put artificial stall warning and stick pushers in the thing. And it picked all that up, and from that moment on was solved. The only other little thing I will say about it was, before we put the artificial stall warning and stick pusher system in, it would stall beautifully out of turns. If you're doing a turning stall and you pulled it in, every time it just flicked out of the turn and sat up in level flight. And it didn't matter which way you did the turn, it never flicked into the thing, it flicked out every time. Whereas the direction in which it was going to flick in level flight was entirely unpredictable. However,
it was very successful, because whenever I go to America, you often see jet streams on provincial airports.
Yes, they're all over the world. Well, all over America and here. Yeah. You can go to Southampton. They're in and out of Southampton here every day, continuously. Yes, the aeroplane, there's nothing wrong with the jet stream. A lot of people blamed it for the demise of Handley Page. But it wasn't the jet stream that caused that. The jet stream was a very good aeroplane. And especially developed. There were sort of problems with the first one, not handling-wise, but performance-wise, really. Load-carrying performance was its problem. But had Handley Page stayed in the business, that would have been resolved, and much sooner than it subsequently happened, in fact. But, it was a very good aeroplane, and before Handley Page went out of business, something like the 80th aeroplane was coming off the production line, and I don't know how many, 40 or 50 probably were delivered to the USA by that time. And as you say, now if you go to the States and you have a short haul to do after arrival, the chances are it's a jet stream you ride in. But the only other thing I really wanted to say about the Mark II Victor was, as an example of its performance in those days, when we had the definitive engine, that's the RCO 17 Conway fitted, you could have a Mark II Victor on the end of the runway at Radlett, and provided that the radar control people would give you an unrestricted climb out from Radlett, you could open up power against the brakes on the runway, and when you got to about 85% power, that thing was going to go, whether you held the brakes or not. It wasn't going to turn the wheels round, because the brakes would hold it, but it was just going to drag the tires. And so you had to let go. And the moment you let go, you just put the throttles on the front to full power, and at the same time hit a stopwatch. And from that moment, you could be out of 20,000 feet in 2 minutes and 8 seconds.
And from brakes off?
From brakes off, and that meant the takeoff run, the bit that you had to hold the speed back for getting wheels and flaps and the rest cleaned up, and then the acceleration to 360 knots for the climb, and then just rotate it nose upwards to hold 360 knots. And
that was at the takeoff weight that would get you out of Radley.
Yes, that was at 160, probably 165,000 pounds all up weight. If you did it out of Bedford, and I've done it out of Bedford at 220,000 pounds, it made very little difference to it. It did. If you were at 220,000 pounds, it did take longer to get to say 40 or 50,000 feet, but the initial part of it was still very brisk indeed. But I've done it. Oh, I had a plot of it once, and I must have had a dozen different recordings of this, and 2 minutes and 8 seconds was absolutely standard out of 20,000 feet. And you see, that's exceeding 10,000 feet a minute upwards, or it's over 100 miles an hour vertical speed.
And what sort of climb angle were you at?
Very steep. You couldn't see the horizon or anything like that. You could look out sideways and see it, but you were standing up very steep. In fact, I took one young chap whom we were checking out as a co-pilot with me, who'd had jet aeroplane experience before, but nothing quite this sort of jet aeroplane experience. And as I rotated the thing and sat it up, pointing into the sky, he said, "Christ, it's like sitting on the front end of a guided missile." And he wasn't far wrong. And you just had to hold that thing there at 360 knots while it went. And you could hold it at that speed until you hit about 0.85 Mach number and then climb on up from that. But 40,000 feet you went through in 8 minutes.
8 minutes from where?
From brakes off.
Brakes off.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But once again, if it was 58 or something like that you were going to, it ended up about 25 minutes to get there. Most aeroplanes take roughly 25 minutes to get to a sort of sensible ceiling. It's a very, very interesting factor over the years. Almost any aeroplane is 25 minutes.
Well, to cruising altitude.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, yes, cruising altitude. Really, it's maybe a bit higher than that service ceiling sort of thing. But, no, the Mark II Victor with that Conway engine in the 17 was a real 60,000-foot aeroplane. There's no nonsense about that at all. And this was a long time ago.
I know.
I mean, when I talk about this performance, 2 minutes and 8 seconds to 20,000 feet, fighter people don't think too much of that sort of thing. It's everyday sort of stuff. But when you're talking about an aeroplane gracing over 100 tons, in 1962 or sometime,
it's a lot of kinetic energy.
You're going some. Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. Super.
So when did your career at Handley Page come to an end?
Well, when the firm folded.
Yeah. That was what, about 63, wasn't it?
Oh, no. It was the 28th of February, 1970. And that was really the end with Handley Page. I stayed at Radlett because Hawker Siddeley took over the military side of the business there almost immediately. And within 5 days or so of us going out of business, they had a contract for the tanker conversion, which we couldn't get out of the... We'd been trying for a year or more to get out of the ministry, and they wouldn't come up with it. Had they come up with it, we wouldn't have gone out of business.
And you reckon that was a deliberate...
What can you feel? The Air Force desperately wanted the aeroplane, and it took them 5 days to get this thing going with Hawker Siddeley. It's just certain that it was...
There was a big rationalisation then. There was BAC, well, Hawker Siddeley, and what was the third one? They all coalesced, didn't they?
Well, it was the helicopter...
Oh,
thing.
Westerns.
Yes, Westerns were really the other thing, yes. I mean, there were really only two major airframe constructors then. Now it's, of course, only one. But, no, Handley Page didn't have a slot in this thing at all. And so, I mean, one can't help feeling that's why it was engineered out. And
did a lot of the personnel move over to Hawker Siddeley?
Yes, a lot of people went to Hawker Siddeley, and quite a major team of people went up to Woodford, of course, to help with the tanker conversion for the Mark IIs. I didn't go. I didn't stay with it because I was terribly interested in Jetstream, and I stayed on with Jetstream and under an entirely different hat. Finished certain development work and certification work we were doing on Jetstream so that another version of the Jetstream came certificated after Handley Page went out of business, and that was the one that we subsequently sold to the Air Force.
Was that up at Prestwick? You moved up there?
Well, no. This was afterwards. This was all done before it went to Prestwick. Mm. And it went to Prestwick because the Air Force wanted it. Scottish Aviation, who ran the thing at Prestwick in those days, didn't sell it, although many people think they did. They didn't sell it to the Air Force. It was sold by an outfit called Jetstream Aircraft Limited, who were operating at Leavesden. And because it had no means of building aeroplanes, it wasn't an organisation of that sort of size. It was the ministry.
They had the twin pioneer, didn't they?
Well, they that's about all they had.
But where were the jet streams produced at that time, before Prestwick came in on it?
Were at Radlett.
They still had the lines open at Radlett.
Well, no. The jet streams that were sold were really only assembled, not produced. They were late ones that came off the production line. They were all flyers. And they came off the production line, something like 25 or more of them, and they were stored for a while at Northampton Airfield. And then we set up Jetstream Aircraft Limited at Leavesden, where we could work on about two aeroplanes at a time, and these were reassembled, finished and fitted, and sold as executive aeroplanes. Mostly, until we were able, to interest the Air Force. And this resulted in the Air Force having one at Boscombe Down and for a competitive trial with two other American aeroplanes. It won hands down. And the Air Force wanted it. Too late in the day, really. But nevertheless, because they wanted it, someone had to build it, or at least... They only actually built two, I think. There were enough airframes to cover the whole thing. They simply had to reassemble them and equip them to Air Force standards, which, of course, meant quite a lot of work because the Air Force never accepts a civilian standard fit. They had to be set to the Air Force standard because they were wanted for a different job anyway, so trainer aeroplane rather than just a commuter or executive aeroplane. And... I think that, I'm not sure whether they built two or three to fill the order of 25 aeroplanes, but the rest of them were all Handley Page aeroplanes. And
all the ones that got subsequently sold to America, they came off the line at Prestwick, did they?
Or no, as well? there were something, I can't tell you exactly how many, but probably 35 or 40 were from Radlett. Mm. I mean, before the firm went out of business, we were delivering at that sort of rate. Yeah. Oh, yes.
So you stayed with the Jetstream. Did you finish your working life with
it? I virtually finished my working life with the Jetstream. Having developed, and finally certificated the, I forget what we called it, Series 100, I think we called it, the Series 100 version of the Jetstream, which had... a modified engine system on it. It was still Aztazoo engine, but they were bigger Aztazoos and flat rated, and that changed the performance of the aeroplane enormously and made it very much more acceptable for hot climate and high altitude use. and it became a good aeroplane as in that version. And I stayed on with it until all that was over, and then gradually started flying with people who had bought executive jet streams in this country. Morgan Crucible had one. Someone else I can't remember for a minute, and in particular Distillers Company. And I actually ended up just for the last few years of my flying almost entirely for Distillers Company.
As company pilot.
And eventually they bought a new jet stream built at Prestwick with the different engines on it called, what would they call that, the J-31. With the Garrett engines on it. And I ended up finally flying that version of it until I retired. And some few years after I retired, I flew my last Victor flight, which was a Mark II tanker. If I hadn't flown that Mark II tanker, it would have been the only Victor variant that I hadn't flown. And so I was very, very pleased. I was very close to 55 Squadron for many years. And one of the squadron commanders invited me to go up there and take a flight, so I did. And
the left-hand seat? Or?
No, they made me fly right-hand seat, but I flew it. I flew it all the way.
It's in your logbook anyway.
Oh, yes, I flew it all the way. But they didn't just let me loose on it like that. I had to go there for a couple of days and have simulator rides and this sort of thing, and go through all their escape training drill and so on all over again. It was like being in the Air Force for a few days, but it was super. And then I had a really proper flight. They didn't let me sit in the left seat, which I was a little bit sorry about. I actually flew the thing the whole time, and I had something over a two-hour flight. And I ended up doing three ILS runs and overshoots and touch and goes and final landings and everything.
That was at Marham, I suppose.
That was at Marham, yeah. That's right. Mm. And so as a result of that, I actually ended up flying, I think I'm absolutely right in saying, every Victor variant. I don't think there's any variant of the Victor I haven't flown. And I flew every Mark II Victor. I'm pretty sure I flew every Mark I as well.
Were there many variants between Marks?
Well, there are only... Yes.
When Mark I, the Mark II, but I mean...
Well, yes, but then there were PR versions and tanker versions, and then there were the sort of odd experimental versions we had at Radlett. Yes, there is one I didn't fly, and that was the one with the boosted takeoff things. What were those rocket motors that...
Spectres,
De Havilland one.
De Havilland Spectres,
yes, yeah. That's right. We had one, had a Mark I fitted with Spectres. I didn't fly that. That's probably the only one. Spud Murphy did. It only did one flight anyway. And it was all a bit academic because by this time the Mark II Victor was in the act, and the Mark II Victor's takeoff performance beat the Spectre Mark I version like mad anyway. It really wasn't necessary. It was in the pipeline and it happened. But there's a yellow Aster thing, I think, too, with great big long pods under the wings. Mm. I flew that.
What was the Aster?
I think I'm on the right tack that it was yellow Aster. And it was, I think it was sideways looking radar.
Uh-huh.
But they were long, thin pods. You had one under each wing. They looked like a Skybolt under each wing, but they're a bit slimmer than Skybolt.
And since your retirement, have you got any connection with aviation at all?
Well, no, very little really. I try to keep as close as possible. I'm a member of a Handy Page Society, of course, and things like that, but my time is taken up now with so many other things. I'm more of a property person than aviation nowadays, having become involved quite unnecessarily and unexpectedly in it, and I end up having a property company to run, which I don't enjoy over much.
So it helps the pension out, I suppose.
Well, that's right.
Yeah. John, thank you very much for talking to me at such great length. I think what you've told me is going to be of great value to the archive. Thank you.